This study in the New Testament book of Revelation is offered for the edification of all students of God's Word by spiritandtruth.org. Professor Andy Woods of the College of Biblical Studies in Houston, Texas, will lead us in this study. It is our prayer that this study will deepen your understanding of the Bible and allow you to draw closer in your relationship with God through His Son, Jesus Christ. Now let's begin our time of study in the last book of the New Testament.
Well, good morning. We are nearing our completion of the book of Revelation, and we find ourselves this morning in Revelation chapter 17. My name is Dr. Andy Woods. I'm a professor of Bible and theology at the College of Biblical Studies in Houston. In prior lessons, we have seen the outpouring of the seven golden bowls of wrath. The seventh bowl of wrath brought a destruction on Babylon, the headquarters of the Antichrist. And what we have described here in chapter 17, verse 1, all the way through chapter 19, verse 6, is our final non-chronological parenthetical insertion in the book, kind of amplifying this city that we call Babylon. And in fact, if you look at chapter 17, verse 1, it says, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, 'Come here and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot that sits on many waters.'" And so essentially what you have going on in this final non-chronological parenthetical insertion is a description of the destruction of Babylon, but it is also an amplification, if you will, of the seventh bowl judgment. So we have our fifth non-chronological parenthetical insertion. Babylon is destroyed, and we have an expansion of that ancient city. We have an expansion of what is referred to in chapter 16 and verse 19. Now, one of the things to understand about Babylon is Babylon means Babylon. I believe the city is a very literal city. It would be modern-day Iraq, but it will be rebuilt on the banks of the Euphrates River, and it will be the headquarters of the future Antichrist. There are several reasons why I think that. As we advance the slides, we see underlined there literal Babylon. And as we continue on, we see a slide that says literal geography in Revelation. And you'll notice in this slide, and advancing them, the one that follows, all of the geographical references in the book of Revelation are very literal, whether it be Sardis or Philadelphia or any other geographical reference. Why should not Babylon be treated literally as well? And in fact, once Babylon collapses, it will fulfill many prophecies. Advancing the slides, we see Isaiah 13 and also Isaiah 14. And when we look at those prophecies in those chapters very carefully, it talks about a destruction of Babylon that will be sudden, cataclysmic, and final. And as we advance the slides, we actually see many of the images that Isaiah uses. For example, in Isaiah 13, verse 10, he uses an image that shows up in our Lord's Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24:29. Isaiah 13, verse 12 shows up in Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. Matthew 24 is obviously future, and Isaiah makes predictions of that future event as well. And as we advance the slides, we see Isaiah had several oracles against Babylon. And advancing the slides again, we see he had another oracle against Babylon. Not one, but two oracles against Babylon. And we say, well, why do we have two? Why is there a description of Babylon's fall in Isaiah 13 and 14 and another one in Isaiah 21? And I believe that has to do with the fact that Babylon has fallen twice. Babylon fell to the Medes and the Persians in 539 BC. I believe that's what Isaiah 21 is talking about. But Babylon of the future under the Antichrist will fall as well. And I believe that's what Isaiah 13 and 14 is talking about. And as we advance the slides, we see the same reality taking place through the prophecies of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 50 and 51 describes Babylon's terms with sudden cataclysmic language. And as we advance the slides again, we come to a historian named Herodotus. Now, Herodotus tells us, he's an ancient historian, he wrote about 450 B.C., Herodotus tells us how Babylon fell, and it talks about how he, that would be the Persian king, conducted the river by a channel into the lake, and so forth. And as we advance the slides, it says towards the end of that second slide there, Herodotus says, those Babylonians did not know they had been captured. And so essentially what happened in 539 B.C. is Babylon fell by a surprise attack to the Medes and the Persians. As the Medes and the Persians diverted the Euphrates, they tunneled under the wall and they captured Babylon by surprise. In other words, the language of cataclysm in Isaiah 13 and 14 and Jeremiah 50 and 51 has never been fulfilled. Advancing the slides again, we see a historian by the name of Pritchard. Pritchard records for us a translation of Cyrus's boasts as he tried to conquer Babylon, and actually he successfully conquered Babylon in 539. You notice this expression, without any battle. Advancing the slides again, it talks about how he strove for peace, and he actually went out of his way to make sure none of the Babylonian sanctuaries were disturbed in any way. Advancing the slides again, he uses the language unharmed in their former chapels. In other words, he did everything he could to preserve the city of Babylon once he conquered it in 539. And advancing the slides one more time, he did so because he was a polytheist, this man Cyrus, this Persian. He didn't want the Babylonian gods Bel and Nebo, for example, to be mad at him. So we went out of his way to make sure that Babylon was preserved in terms of its remains once it fell to the Persians. And you say, well, why are you bringing all of this up? I'm bringing all of this up because the language of cataclysm that's given in Isaiah 13 and 14 and Jeremiah 50 and 51 has never been satisfied. And in fact, advancing the slides, we take a look at Babylon's history after it fell to the Medes and the Persians in 539 B.C., you see, Isaiah and Jeremiah both predicted that when Babylon falls, she'll never be inhabited again. And yet, after 539, there have been many people who have lived in Babylon. Herodotus gives the measurements of Babylon, and Alexander the Great visited Babylon. And continuing on, going to the next slide, we see Babylonians were even present on the day of Pentecost. And in AD 500, the Talmud was promulgated from Babylon. And my point is, the language of uninhabitability after Babylon falls has never been satisfied. The prophecies of Isaiah 13 and 14 and Jeremiah 50 and 51 remain unfulfilled right up to the present hour. They are waiting the destruction of Babylon, as described in Revelation 17 and 18. And it's not just true with Jeremiah and Isaiah. As we advance the slides, and by the way, going to this slide here that talks about a parallel between Jeremiah 50 and 51 and Revelation 17 and 18, and moving on to the next slide, you see very clearly the parallel between Jeremiah's prophecies and what's described in Revelation 17 and 18. So when are Jeremiah 50 and 51 and Isaiah 13 and 14 going to be fulfilled? They're going to be fulfilled in the events of the future tribulation period, when God brings the Antichrist's city and kingdom to an end with the seventh golden bowl judgment. And advancing the slides, as I hinted at just a few moments ago, we even have this prophecy by Zechariah. Zechariah talks about a woman in a basket, and she is to be set free in the end times. and she is going to return to Shinar. Advancing the slides, we know exactly where Shinar is. It's the area where the city of Babylon once stood. It's the same area where the Tower of Babel once existed. And advancing the slides again, we see that this woman in the basket is none other than the harlot spoken of in Revelation 17 and 18. And it's very interesting that Zechariah had his prophecies about 20 years after historic Babylon fell to the Medes and the Persians in 539 BC. And so Zechariah 5, verses 5 through 11, just like Jeremiah 50 and 51, just like Isaiah 13 and 14, have never been historically fulfilled. Now, as we advance the slides, you'll discover that a lot of people don't believe Babylon means Babylon in the book of Revelation. They want it to mean Jerusalem or Rome or, you know, some kind of religious system. And the problem is the word Babylon in the Bible has a very specific meaning. Remember, John is using Old Testament concepts. And in the Old Testament, Babylon always means Babylon. It never is a code for some other city. And so John, when he speaks of Babylon, I believe is speaking of literal Babylon. And all of these other views want to substitute some other word for the word Babylon. And even beyond that, as we advance the slides, many people try to argue that, well, it can't be literal Babylon because it's called Mystery Babylon. And so they want this to mean mystic Babylon of some kind. That is the title that's in the harlot's forehead in Revelation 17, verse 5. But you'll notice that the King James Version and the NIV have mystery in capital letters, but the New American Standard has mystery in small letters. And I believe the New American Standard Bible has it right here, because Babylon the Great is used many times in the book of Revelation, and never once is she referred to as Mystery Babylon, or Mystic Babylon, or Symbolic Babylon. In other words, there's a judgment call that the translators of the Bible make in terms of translating Revelation 17, verse 5, this title in the harlot's forehead. They can either translate it as Mystery Babylon with mystery in capital letters, or they can put mystery in small letters, indicating that Babylon is a mystery, but her title is not Mystery Babylon. And so, in essence, what you have is, I believe, the New American Standard Bible having it right, because the title that they have used and translated is consistent with all the other titles in the book of Revelation. So don't get this idea that it's Mystic Babylon or Symbolic Babylon. Babylon means Babylon. And when Babylon falls, it's going to fulfill numerous prophecies about the destruction of Babylon, which were predicted by Isaiah and Jeremiah and Zechariah, which have never been literally fulfilled. And as we continue to advance the slides, it talks about Babylon as the mother of all harlots. In other words, she is the source of all harlotry. And the only way you can understand this is to understand this as a revived Tower of Babel. Because in the Tower of Babel incident, there was only one language. And God confounded the languages of the builders, you'll recall, in Genesis 11, so they could not cooperate with each other. And from Babel came forth multiple nations and cultures and people groups. And they brought with them into their unique culture Babylonian harlotry. And so the Tower of Babel is the only true mother of harlots, or the source of all harlotry. Clarence Larkin, in his commentary of the Tower of Babel, says this was the origin of the nations. But the nations were not scattered abroad over the earth until Satan had implanted in them the virus of a doctrine that has been the source of every false religion the world has ever known. And so Jerusalem is not the source of all harlotry. That really doesn't make any sense, because Jerusalem absorbed harlotry, but she is not the source of all harlotry. Neither is Rome. Rome comes on the stage far too late in the game to be the source of all harlotry. Rome is a daughter harlot. She absorbed harlotry into her, but she is not the mother or source of all harlotry. And so this mother of harlotry language, the only way to understand it is to understand it as a dialing back to the Tower of Babel. And so all of that said, what I think is being described here is Babylon means Babylon. When Babylon falls in Revelation 17 and Revelation 18, it will fulfill numerous prophecies in the Old Testament. And the Antichrist city will be reconstructed in the tribulation period, only to be destroyed with the seventh bowl judgment. And Revelation 17 and 18 are sort of a parenthetical break in the action or an expansion of ancient what we call ancient Babylon revived as she is destroyed and as she falls. Many people have these very peculiar views on Babylon. They think Revelation 17 is some kind of system which falls midway through the tribulation period. And Revelation 18 is a literal city that falls at the end of the tribulation period. But I'd like to communicate the idea that this is just one city here that's described in these chapters. We know it's a city because Revelation 17 verse 18 says, "The woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth." So let's not take Revelation 17 as just kind of a religious system when the Bible clearly tells us that this harlot is an actual city that falls. And there, the forces that bring Revelation 17 and 18 together are greater than any forces that divide these chapters. For example, they're called the same name. The city is called the same name in both chapters. She's called a city in both chapters. She is bedecked with purple and gold in both chapters. Both chapters, 17 and 18, describe her as fornicating with kings. And as we advance the slides, both chapters describe her as drunk with the wine of her immorality. Both chapters describe her as persecuting believers. Both chapters describe Babylon as being destroyed by fire. And ultimately, both chapters describe Babylon as being destroyed by God. So it is a singular city that comes to its demise in Revelation 17 and 18, which is an expansion of the seventh bowl judgment. As we advance the slides, we see that Babylon will be destroyed in an hour. And you see that in Revelation 18, verse 10, and many other passages. It's true that Revelation 17 could be highlighting the religious elements of the city. The city will be the headquarters of a one-world religion. Revelation 17 could be emphasizing more the religious components of the city. Revelation 18 could very well be emphasizing the commercial components of the city. The city will be headquarters of a one world commercial system, but it's still the same city. And it's just like the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel was a city of religion. It was the headquarters of the mother child cults. But the city was also a literal commercial city. It was religious and commercial. Revelation 17, Babylon's religious element is highlighted. Revelation 18, Babylon's commercial element is highlighted. But this singular city is destroyed in a single hour. So all of the hopes of the world in terms of building a world system without God comes crashing to the ground once the final bowl judgment is poured out. Revelation 17 tells us that God uses the beast to destroy Babylon. Revelation 18 simply says God destroys Babylon. But you notice that both chapters are a discussion of God himself destroying Babylon. Chapter 17 just adds a little detail. Oh, by the way, the Lord is actually going to use the Antichrist to destroy Babylon. So somehow God puts it in the heart of the beast to accomplish God's own purposes. And perhaps at some point the beast himself, the Antichrist, becomes jealous that the city of Babylon is gaining too much attention. We're not sure exactly how all of this will work, but the beast goes out and actually destroys Babylon, and Revelation 18 simply says God was using the beast to destroy Babylon. So Babylon comes crashing to the ground, and the moment that happens, we move into Revelation 19, verses 1 through 6, where heaven begins to rejoice after Babylon falls. The angels, the 24 elders, the four living creatures begin to celebrate in heaven because the Antichrist's city, the epitome of evil, has been destroyed. And now that Babylon has fallen, the judgments of God are complete. The seventh bowl judgment has been poured out. And now we move away from the events of the seven-year tribulation period, which is where we have been spending most of our time in our prior lessons. We now move into four events which will take place following the tribulation period. So the tribulation period is over, and the only thing we have left to study in the book of Revelation are four events, and they are as follows. The second advent of Jesus Christ, Revelation 19, Jesus is returning to the earth. Revelation 20, verses 1 through 10, the establishment of Christ's millennial or thousand-year kingdom. Then in the second half of Revelation 20, verses 11 through 15, we'll have a discussion there of something called the Great White Throne Judgment, which is a judgment for all unbelievers. And then the world that we are currently in will be dissolved by fire. 2 Peter 3, verse 10 seems to indicate that, and it will be replaced by a totally new world called the Eternal State, or the New Heavens and the New Earth. And God will set up his final city called the New Jerusalem. As we advance the slides, we can see those final four events portrayed in graphic form. You notice the tribulation period ends, and then we have four events that follow. The second coming of Christ, chapter 19. The millennial kingdom, chapter 20. The great white throne judgment, chapter 20, and then finally time will end and eternity will begin in the new heavens and the new earth, Revelation 21 and 22. So let's take a look as we advance the slides at the first of these four events. The first is called the second advent of Christ. You see it described in Revelation 19. Verses 7 through 21, advancing the slides again, you see that the second advent, when it's portrayed graphically or pictorially, follows the tribulation period. So we're not talking here about the rapture of the church. The church has already been taken to heaven by Jesus Christ before the tribulation period even begins. But now Jesus Christ is returning along with his church at the end of the tribulation period to bring forth the kingdom of God upon the earth, which is what we have all been anticipating as we have been studying the book of Revelation together. As we advance the slides, we see John is so enthralled by what he is receiving. You might recall in one of our earlier lessons, we said John received this information from an angel. John is so enthralled by what he receives from this angel that he actually begins to worship the angel. And Revelation 19, verse 10, the angel says, "Hey, stop it. Don't worship me. I'm just a servant of God." And John won't learn his lesson because the same thing will happen in Revelation 22. And it's sort of interesting to me that John wrapped up his little book on 1 John in chapter 5, verse 21, by saying, "Little children, keep yourselves from idols." You know, an idol is something we worship instead of God. And John himself didn't follow his own advice because you find him making an idol out of a messenger of God. And people sometimes do that. They take spokesmen for God and put them on a pedestal. And we ought not to worship human beings or individuals. Our worship ought to go directly to God. But at any rate, what we have described here is the second advent of Jesus Christ. His return is described in Revelation 19, verses 11 through 16. He is coming back on a white horse. He is called the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. This is not the same white horse, rider on the white horse, that we studied earlier in Revelation 6. That was the coming Antichrist. But this is the true Christ that's coming. And he is not going to bring in a pseudo peace or a false peace, but he is going to bring in what we would call a permanent peace called the Millennial Kingdom. And the armies of the earth actually go out to fight him. And can you imagine something as silly as going out to fight God? That's how hard the human heart is against God at this time in history. And these armies are immediately slaughtered by Jesus Christ. It's sort of anticlimactic in a certain sense. We've learned all of this information about the devil and his powers and his armies and so forth. And the text describes it just as an immediate conquest by Jesus Christ. There doesn't even seem to be much of a battle here. But what is happening is you've got these dead carcasses laying all over the place. And consequently, what happens is the vultures and the disgusting birds come and gorge on the human flesh. You might recall Jesus predicted the same thing would happen in Matthew chapter 24, around verse 28. And this man, Jesus Christ, it's very interesting, takes the beast and the false prophet. You'll see a reference to this in Revelation 19, verse 20. He takes those two individuals and he throws them into the lake of fire. So the beast and the false prophet are really the first inhabitants into the lake of fire. And consequently, what we have is the return of Jesus Christ in Revelation 19. And as we advance the slides once again, we see the second of four events that will take place once the tribulation period is over is after the second advent of Christ, we will have the Millennial Kingdom, which is the thousand-year reign of Christ that we have been anticipating all of this time. Advancing the slides again, you see that the Millennial Kingdom will follow the second advent. And the view that I'm presenting is called pre-millennialism. Jesus Christ will return at the end of the tribulation period, and then the Millennial Kingdom will follow. So we are, or I am anyway, what's called a pre-millennialist. I'm not anticipating the thousand-year kingdom to come into existence until Jesus Christ returns first. So first Christ comes back, and then the thousand-year kingdom will result. And actually, this may seem kind of like pie-in-the-sky theology, but the fact of the matter is what you believe about this issue will largely dominate what you think the local church today should be doing. Many churches today are teaching about social justice. They're teaching about bringing in the kingdom. They're talking about how the church needs to manifest the kingdom of God on the earth and those kinds of things. As for me personally, in my local church, I don't waste a lot of my time in the pulpit talking about our need to establish social justice on the earth. I believe that those things will only come into existence when, in fact, Jesus Christ sets them up. I don't think we can have the kingdom without the king. So what is going on here is Jesus comes back first, Revelation 19, and then the kingdom follows. I'm not anticipating a kingdom without the king first being present. Now, what is this kingdom going to be like? What kind of circumstances will exist upon the earth? And in our next and final session together, we'll take a good hard look at that issue and many other issues as well.